Hello, hello. Welcome back, guys. Oh my goodness, December 2020. How did this come along so quickly? At the time that I'm releasing this podcast, it is indeed the week of Christmas. And while I could bring you some Christmas episode, I decided not to. What I decided to do instead was release one of my absolute favorite interviews of the year, which is with the lovely Jessie Brebner. Before I introduce you to Jessie and tell you a little bit more about her, I wanted to just quickly jump in and remind you that if you're someone who is suffering from gut issues like bloating, discomfort, loose stools or constipation, if you have multiple food intolerances, you have no idea what the F you can eat anymore without feeling any of those digestive issues, or you feel like you've tried to do all these different diets or gut healing diets and haven't really gotten the results that you want, then I have some fabulous news for you. There is a new program coming in 2021 called Gut Rescue, and you can pop your name down on the wait list right now by heading to the link in my Instagram bio or by going directly to my website nataliekdouglas.com and navigating to the tab that says Gut Rescue. So the program will begin in February 2021, but there's only a limit of 10 spaces for the first round, so make sure that your name is down on that waitlist and you keep checking your emails in across the Christmas period, because I will be sharing more information on how you can grab one of those 10 spots and start feeling far more digestively comfortable than ever before. So let's chat about the lovely Jessie. So Jessie Brebner, or some of you may know her as the Instagram account Fertility Charting, is a passionate advocate for fertility awareness as a gateway to improved health, body literacy, and reproductive empowerment. She is a certified symptothermal method instructor for both natural birth control, natural conception, and health tracking. She is also the creator of fertility charting journals, and Jessie is passionate about the power of social media for communicating menstrual cycle health concepts. She also regularly blogs on menstrual cycles, fertility charting, journaling, natural contraception or conception, and so much more. And she shared so much fabulous information during this episode that I just cannot wait for you to hear, to learn about, and to most importantly, start to use yourself and share with those around you, because it's a topic that I know that I'm not alone in feeling like it needs more attention. So without further ado or me going on another banter, I will let the podcast begin, and I look forward to hearing all of your thoughts on Instagram in the comments or in my DMs after you have a listen. Enjoy. Jessie, welcome to the Holistic Nutritionist podcast. It's so good to finally have you on after Insta following you for quite some time now, actually.
Thanks, Natalie. I'm so excited to be here. It's always a pleasure jumping on with the podcast, and I'm excited to chat more about my favorite subject.
Yes, I know. It's definitely up there in my top three. I love talking about poos, periods, and I also love talking about thyroid. So we're both in our element here.
We're on the same page.
Absolutely. So the first question I have for you is, what's something that's inspiring you or exciting you in the world of natural medicine or your area of talking about periods and conception and contraception right now?
So many things. I mean, I think I'm a little bit biased, but I think in the world of natural health and natural medicine, I think the thing that is most exciting me at the moment is that more and more holistic health practitioners seem to be linking up and networking and collaborating with fertility awareness educators. And it's like this beautiful symbiotic relationship where you're seeing more and more people referring between the two industries. And I think that's really, really nice to see. And it's something that's really exciting for me to see too.
Yes, I think it's so valuable because, I mean, as a practitioner myself, there's only so much time we have to go through so many things. And I think that being able to have someone like yourself to really learn the nitty gritty of, practicing like the fertility awareness method, having someone to go over your charts with you as well, sometimes, especially when you're first learning, is just so helpful for sure.
Totally. Absolutely. And, you know, from my end, you know, it takes so long to teach all the nitty gritty granular details of the method. But when I see so many charts, you know, from my clients, and it's inevitable that a lot of people are experiencing hormonal issues and hormonal imbalances. And that's not something I'm trained to help anyone with, but it's really nice to have those networks with other practitioners who can look at those charts and use them to troubleshoot things. So it's really nice just having that back and forth relationship.
Yes, totally. So speaking of the fertility awareness method, I feel like this term, a lot of people, at least that are listening to our podcast, have probably heard myself or Kate or speak about it before. However, I think that a good thing to clarify first up, or what I'd like you to clarify, is what are people actually referring to when they say the fertility awareness method, and are there multiple interpretations of what that might mean?
Yes. So... This is a great question. Essentially, the term fertility awareness method, it usually refers to the symptothermal method. So it's like a colloquialism. It's often shortened to the acronym FAM or FAM. And it's really a colloquialism, a term for the symptothermal method. So I'll take it back a little bit and just, I guess, give an overview of like the structure of these methods. So basically, we've got this umbrella term called fertility awareness-based methods, FABMs. And that is an umbrella term that refers to all methods of monitoring fertility, monitoring menstrual cycles for the purposes of pregnancy prevention or natural contraception, or even just monitoring your health. So we've got this umbrella term, but then within that umbrella term, there are lots of different types of fertility awareness-based methods. So you've got calendar only based methods, which is like the rhythm method where you just, you know, you've got your calendar and you're crossing off dates and counting between, you know, the time between periods. A lot of apps are like that. They're just like an app form of a calendar. And then you've got calculothermal methods, which are when you're combining that calendar tracking with your temperature. So you've got apps that do that, like Natural Cycles or Daisy. And then you've got the cervical mucus only methods, and they are entire methods built around tracking cervical mucus. And then you've got symptothermal methods, which are cervical mucus and basal body temperature. And that's where that colloquial term FAM comes from. It's a colloquial term for the symptothermal method. And then you've got symptohormonal methods, which are basically cervical mucus and testing urinary hormone metabolites. So there's a range of different types of fertility awareness-based methods. And then within each of those silos, there are many different organizations teaching different variations of those methods. So it's a really, really big world once you start investigating the world of fertility awareness-based methods. But yeah, at a very basic level, the term FAM, it usually refers to the symptothermal method, and that's the method that I teach.
I love it. And let's from here set the tone that we'll refer to it from now on in the podcast as FAM, now that we're all on the same page, so I don't have Perfect. To say that. I feel like that would be great. And it's so good to clarify that, hey, because I know when I was first kind of looking into it, I was like, whoa, there's a lot of different ways to do this, and it was very confusing when I first started to learn about it myself. So I know, at least for me, one of the first questions that clients always ask is, how reliable is FAM as a form of contraception, especially compared to other common methods that people might be using? So for example, condoms or the pill or the Mirena, for example.
Totally. This is a really important question, and I love it when people ask this question because it means that they're serious about preventing a pregnancy and they're probably going to be a good user of the symptothermal method. So I guess to break it down, it's important to distinguish between the two different types of contraceptive effectiveness, because when we get all these figures and statistics thrown at us, some of them may be more or less relevant to real life. So we've got two types. We've got perfect use effectiveness and typical use effectiveness. And perfect use effectiveness is if we're going to be using the method perfectly every single time and it reflects an ideal scenario. And then you've got typical use effectiveness, and that's really when, you know, you're not practicing the method perfectly every single time. You know, if you're taking the pill, you're forgetting a few mornings, or you're taking it at a different time than usual. And that really reflects a real world scenario, so that it reflects real life. And so we need to keep in mind both of these effectiveness types when we look at the effectiveness of the symptothermal method. So I guess the main thing that we can start with is perfect use. So perfect use for the symptothermal method has been shown to be up to 99.6% effective, which is highly effective. So that's actually based on a 2007 study that was published in Germany, and a group of researchers followed around 900 women for 17,638 menstrual cycles. So a really long period of time, a lot of menstrual cycles, and they were working very, very closely with an instructor. And it was shown that the method, the particular method, was up to 99.6% effective. So it is definitely possible to be an extremely effective and very safe method. So that's something that I think is really encouraging and really reassuring for a lot of people. And then the next part of it is typical use, right? So we want to know what's it going to be like in real life. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of information about the typical use rates of the symptothermal method. And the reason for that is that, you know, perfect use rates are preferably calculated in clinical trials, because the parameters of the trial are controlled very strictly and it's going to reflect a very accurate perfect use rate. However, typical use rates, we want those to be calculated from large population-based surveys. So, you know, think, I mean, it's not the census, but think like a census, like a big survey goes out and you tick, you know, a box. Oh, I've used this method of birth control and it's failed or not failed, you know, that kind of thing. But the problem is that there are not enough users of the symptothermal method to provide statistically valid typical use effectiveness rates from those big surveys. And so what that means is usually they lump in all the different types of fertility awareness-based methods, so symptothermal, symptohormonal, rhythm, all that kind of thing, lump them all together, and that's the only way you can get a large enough user base of people to generate that statistically valid result. And unfortunately, that means that officially the typical use for all types of fertility awareness-based methods, that umbrella, is about 85% effective. And unfortunately, that's skewed heavily downwards because the vast majority of respondents to these surveys use the rhythm method, which is a very outdated old school method, which is very ineffective, and I don't recommend it. So I guess all that to say that the symptothermal method itself is highly effective with perfect use when learned with an instructor. We don't know how effective it is for people who don't learn with an instructor, because that has never been studied. But we don't really have typical use rates. We know that from that clinical trial, the typical use was 98.2% effective, which is, again, fantastic, but it's probably not, relatable to real life because it was a clinical trial. But just to compare that perfect use rate, so we know that the pill is 99.7% effective with perfect use. So, you know, symptothermal method is 99.6% effective with perfect use. So that's a fantastic comparison there. Condoms, when you're just using condoms and that's all you're using, are only about 98% effective with perfect use. And then obviously on the other side, you've got things like the Mirena, which are 99.9% effective with perfect use. So there's a big range there, and it is, you know, researchers do warn us that you can't really compare directly between all these different types of contraceptives because the studies are kind of done differently. It's really hard to compare the symptothermal method to other types of contraception. So I'm babbling on and I'm boring everyone, but it's a really big topic and it is really important. I think I'll just finish off by emphasizing that, you know, the method, while it is highly effective with perfect use, it's a really user-dependent method. So, you know, you have the responsibility for learning the method effectively, working with an instructor, and you need to be able to, A, observe your fertility biomarkers, and B, you need to chart them correctly, C, you need to be able to apply the rules of the method to the chart, and D, finally, you do need to be able to modify your sexual behavior because you're going to need to abstain from sex during the fertile window. Or alternatively, you can use barrier methods, but you need to keep in mind that that means you're deferring to the effectiveness of the barrier method because mm-hmm. that's all you're using during the fertile window. So it's a really big subject, but the main takeaway is that it is possible to achieve an extremely high effectiveness rate on par with the pill when using the symptothermal method.
Yeah, and I don't think you're boring us at all. I actually think it's so interesting. And I'm so glad you pointed out that some of that research or the research referring to the effectiveness does lump all of the different types in. And we'll chat a little bit more about the problem with relying on apps only shortly, because I think this is one of those so common. You wouldn't believe how many times I you know, which understandably, but I'll be in a consultation and I'll say, have you ovulated yet? We're about to in your cycle. And the response is, one second, I'll just get my app out. And, you know, I totally get it because life is busy. And if you're not consciously checking in with your body, or you're not even aware of what the signs are that ovulation is coming or it's happened or anything like that, it's really easy just to rely on an app. And I think apps are incredible, but also dangerous if people aren't aware of the fact of how they're actually constructed and how it is used, because I think there's even a lot of misinformation out there, at least I noticed in my client population, around cycle length and what is a normal cycle. A lot of women that I speak to say they might have a 32-day cycle and they say, oh, I've got a really long cycle, it's not normal because it's not 28 days. Do you ever run into that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. There's just such a huge misconception around that. So, like, you know, a lot of GPs and a lot of mainstream health messaging does kind of focus on that 28-day cycle. And, you know, like, studies have shown, I think it's like around 10% of people actually have a 28-day menstrual cycle, and that's about it. So it's really, you know, there is a much wider range of normal. I mean, the official definition is around 24 to 38 days. I mean, I'm not sure where that fits in with your perspective being a holistic health practitioner, but it's, yeah, there is a far wider range of normal than we realize, for sure.
Yeah, totally. So I think it's, yeah, re-education around that, definitely, because otherwise so many people think they've got issues with long or short cycles when actually that's just what is normal for them. So absolutely. Speaking of kind of variable cycle lengths, something that I wanted to clear up, because again, it's another really common question when we're talking about FAM, is that if someone has an irregular cycle, so say they're working with a holistic healthcare practitioner because they've got PCOS and their cycle length varies each cycle, can they still actually effectively use the FAM method even though their cycle may be different lengths each time?
Yeah, so this is a fantastic question, and I find there's a lot of misinformation out there on this question, especially if you research FAM or the symptothermal method on like government websites or mainstream health websites. They'll often say that it's only effective if you have a very regular cycle, which is completely untrue. It's misinformation, really. So the thing to keep in mind is that the symptothermal method doesn't make predictions about your current cycle based on your past cycles in a way that would put you at risk for an unintended pregnancy. So we do actually make some predictions based on past cycles, but they're only ever used to add safety to the method, so add extra buffer days or anything like that. It never takes away any of the safety. I think the main thing to remember is that using the symptothermal method, you're actually checking in at the end of each day and saying, am I fertile today? Mm. Am I fertile today? What did my cervical mucus say? What did my basal body temperature say? Where am I in my cycle? And this is something really important to make the distinction about. You're tracking your fertility in real time. Whereas if you are, you know, just say you're using an app or whatever, that's when, you know, not having a regular cycle would be a problem, right? Because you're making predictions based on past cycles. But when you're tracking your fertility on a daily basis, it's not about making predictions based on past cycles. And it's totally fine for anyone with PCOS or long cycles or irregular cycles to use the symptothermal method, and it doesn't change the effectiveness. The I guess the main thing to be aware of is that, you know, irregular cycles, it doesn't make a difference. You could have, you know, a 27-day cycle and then a 36-day cycle and then a 25-day cycle and then a 45-day cycle. It wouldn't make a single iota of difference to anyone practicing the symptothermal method. However, if you have really long cycles, it is important to mention that this can mean that you have an extended period of time during your cycle where you would need to be either abstaining from sexual intercourse or using a barrier method. And the problem with that is that if you choose to use a barrier method for that extended period of time, then you are, you know, falling back on the effectiveness of that barrier method, which can sometimes be a lot lower. So condoms obviously are around 98% effective, and that is lower than the symptothermal method. You know, there are ways to get around that and things that we can help you with, such as talking about doubling up with different types of contraception and all that type of thing. But at the end of the day, the method itself is completely accessible for anyone with long cycles, anyone with irregular cycles, anyone with PCOS. And if you ever did get to a point where, you know, you were learning the method and it just didn't seem like it was going to be a good fit, there are lots of other types of fertility awareness-based methods, and your instructor is usually going to be pretty good at saying, hey, look, you know, you're terrible at taking your temperature each day. I don't think this is working out for you, but how about you look into a symptohormonal method or a cervical mucus only method? You know, there's so many different avenues that you can explore when you're trying to find something that's going to work correctly for you.
Yeah, so true. And it really is about, yeah, matching the right method to you and your lifestyle and what you are actually going to do in practice, as opposed to what is, you know, the ideal way to do something. For example, I think the ideal way is the way that you're going to do, you know, how it's supposed to be done. Otherwise, it becomes ineffective. Like you gave the example of someone who, for example, might be on the pill and not taking it regularly, or skipping days, or, you know, using barrier protection but forgetting to actually put the condom on, you know, like
exactly.
You know, exactly. It's about what am I actually going to use?
Yeah.
So I guess just on the apps again, because I feel like this is something I want to hone in on. What are some of the common mistakes you see people make when they're using apps to track their cycle? So we've kind of alluded to one of them in that, you know, people just assume that their calendar on their app is exactly right, and that's when they're ovulating, and then that's when they are going to get their period. Do you see anything, any other potential problems popping up with apps or even different apps?
Yeah. It's a minefield. It really, this topic is a minefield because it's really quite complex. But I think one of the main things is just seeing people putting their blind faith and blind trust in an app to tell you what your body is doing. Because, you know, I guess to take it back and explain a few things, your app is, if you're using an app that is giving you predictions about when you're going to ovulate or when you're going to get your period, and maybe you're inputting things like your start and end dates of your period or cervical mucus or that sort of thing, these apps are making assumptions to give you those predictions. And what they're doing is they are taking averages from the rest of the population and they're applying them to your charts, And they're also taking your previous charts and assuming that every subsequent menstrual cycle that you have is going to be very similar to the previous menstrual cycles that you've had. And the problem with that is that ovulation itself is a very sensitive, finicky little event, and it takes so much energy from our bodies to ovulate, and it's very easily impacted by many outside influences. So, you know, if you're traveling, if you're trying a new diet, maybe you've decided to go keto and you're not eating very many carbs, maybe you're trying new supplements, maybe you've gone on a big traveling experience, or maybe you've started some really intense high intensity workouts every week. You know, all these different things can very easily impact our ovulation and make it a lot later than usual. And there's also many things that can cause us to ovulate earlier than usual too. So that's where things get dangerous, because, you know, we need advance warning to stop having unprotected sex at least 5 to 7 days before ovulation, because sperm can survive up to 5 to 7 days in our reproductive tract. So if we're not getting enough advance notice to stop having sex, then we do put ourselves at risk of an unintended pregnancy. And I actually just recently saw, just this morning, a perfect example of this. Someone had an app and it had told her, you know, this is when your fertile window has ended. You're now safe for unprotected sex. And it turns out that she hadn't even ovulated at that point. She was experiencing a delayed ovulation. And if she had have continued having unprotected sex because she thought she was in the safe phase of her cycle, she would have just completely placed herself at a very high risk of unintended pregnancy, simply because the app is just making guesses. It's, you know, they're informed guesses, but they're still guesses. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things. And, you know, there's lots of different types of apps. There are apps that are just supposed to be period trackers, and then there are apps that are supposedly going to give you information about contraception. So they're to be used for pregnancy prevention. And those might be things like Natural Cycles or Daisy, and you're putting in your temperatures each day. And even that, a lot of people think that it's like very scientific and I'm putting in my temperatures and it's all well and good. But the problem with that is that your temperature, it really only rises after you've ovulated. So in the lead up to ovulation, your temperature has no predictive value. It can't tell you when ovulation is approaching. And those apps actually use your past cycles to make a guess as to when the fertile window opens in your current cycle. So again, making guesses, even if they're informed guesses, is still a problem because they are guesses. So unless you're working with like daily real-time information about your fertility, and you know, you're using a sign that's influenced by estrogen, because estrogen is the hormone that rises in the lead up to ovulation, unless you're tracking a sign that's influenced by estrogen, then there's not really any way to get warning that ovulation is approaching.
So true. Another thing that I don't know if you get people, or actually I think you might, because you get people to, do you get people to paper chart when you're teaching them first, or do you get them to use apps to enter in their observations?
Yeah, so during the first three cycles of charting, I do require my clients to use a paper chart if possible. I mean, I'm not forcing anyone, but it's strongly encouraged. And the reason for that is because it really cements the concepts when you are having to map everything out on paper, on a chart. And I think it really brings those concepts home. In saying that, you know, if you do want to use an app, that's totally fine, but you just need to treat it like a paper chart. So it's just somewhere to store your information, and you should be using the rules of the method to analyze that information yourself. So don't rely on the app to analyze it. Don't rely on the app to give you predictions. You should just be able to look at that information and use the specific rules of the symptothermal method that you've preferably learned with an instructor, or you've read a method manual, and then apply those rules to the data that you've collected. So it's not like apps are a terrible bad thing. They're actually fantastic because they make it so much easier for people to carry around a chart with them, you know, but it's all about learning the role they play and understanding their limitations.
Yeah. And you can turn off the app predictions in the settings of most ones. I use Kindara and I just turn off the predictor things. Otherwise it's too tempting to just rely on it. And the other thing I really like to do is for myself, and also I encourage clients to do this, is to use their own words. I think sometimes there's this need to fit the descriptions of mucus into something else that perhaps doesn't necessarily resonate. And you might be describing the same thing, but I think it's so important to actually use your words so that you become really familiar with your body. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And this is one of the key reasons that I do get clients to paper chart, because the problem is that a lot of apps, they have cervical mucus categories that don't necessarily match the categories of the method that I teach. And it's definitely problematic because it can make things quite confusing when you're in the learning stage and your instructor or your method manual is saying, here's the categories for cervical mucus. And then your app is saying, it's just sticky, creamy, egg white, or watery, you know. So there's definitely some issues there. And I think something that is exciting is the release of a new app. So have you heard of the Read Your Body app?
No, tell me.
Okay, so this is a fantastic app. It was actually crowdfunded by the fertility awareness community, and it was released probably, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago maybe. And it is basically designed for fertility awareness-based method charters to have complete customization. So you can write in your own cervical mucus categories. You can, you know, chart in Fahrenheit or Celsius. You can map 2 different levels of temperatures. There's so much that you can do with it. And I actually refer all my clients to the Read Your Body app now instead of Kindara. So don't get me wrong, I love Kindara. It's a fantastic app, but Read Your Body does offer a lot more customization, which is really important for me as an instructor when I want to ensure that my clients are able to learn the method without that confusion of those different categories and things.
Yeah, yeah, because I definitely think the struggle can be real when you're first trying to, you're like looking at your mucus and you're being like, well, I don't know, is it water? Is this watery? Is this, like, it's so hard. And then one day you might think, oh, it's close to this, and another day you might change your mind of what it looks like, whereas if you've used your own words, it makes so much more sense. So I'm really glad that there's that app. I'll have to download it when we jump off the call. I'm excited.
Yeah, definitely do. It's worth it.
So good. So another question, just speaking of cervical mucus and fitting into categories, this is another one that I feel like pops up a lot. And it's this common message out there that you're only experiencing fertile mucus if it looks like egg white. Can you debunk this for us, please?
I would love to debunk this one. So something important to keep in mind is that when you're using the symptothermal method, we consider all types of cervical mucus to be fertile in the follicular phase prior to ovulation. So after your period ends, you know, you might have some dry days, and then you might have some sticky or tacky or gummy days. And then as the water content increases, it might get a little bit more milky or creamy, or, you know, it kind of changes as you get closer to ovulation. But a lot of the time, especially on Instagram and social media, I see a lot of, I guess, posts saying that sticky cervical mucus is not fertile. And the problem with that is that all types of cervical mucus can keep sperm alive, even if it's only for a few hours. Often that can be enough time for your cervix to begin producing more fertile types of cervical mucus. So it's not, you know, it's kind of a complex question, but, you know, different types of cervical mucus are more or less fertile, but none of them are not fertile at all. So sticky cervical mucus isn't quite as fertile or conducive to sperm survival as egg white style cervical mucus, but it's still fertile and it can still keep sperm alive. So that's, I guess, looking at it from a pregnancy prevention standpoint, we can say it's really important to recognize that all types of cervical mucus can harbor sperm and keep them alive in the reproductive tract prior to ovulation. But then from another perspective, if you're trying to conceive, you might be seeing all these posts talking about slippery egg whites, and you might be thinking, well, hang on, I don't really ever see egg whites in my underwear. What is something wrong with me? And I guess, again, the thing to keep in mind is that a lot of people are only going to be talking about the textbook menstrual cycle, which does typically follow a pattern of you've got your period, then you've got a few days of dry, and then you might transition from sticky to gummy to creamy or milky, and then egg white, and then maybe watery. Mm-hmm. And the thing about that is that that's a textbook cycle, and a lot of us don't have textbook cycles or textbook hormones. We're very unique individual creatures. So it's something to keep in mind is that a lot of people actually have a water content so high of their peak type cervical mucus that it transitions from looking like egg whites to simply being really slippery water. It might even kind of gush out of the vaginal opening, and you can't really pick it up and look at it because it's just super slippery, watery fluid at the vaginal entrance. And then some people might basically see nothing externally, but they might just feel really slippery as they're walking around throughout the day. So they might just have this slippery sensation at the vulva. They may even almost feel as though they can feel their labia sliding against each other as they're walking around. And again, all of those are variations that indicate high levels of fertility, so very high levels of estrogen that typically occur just prior to the release of an egg. Obviously, there's no guarantee that if you see those things, you're ovulating, it reflects estrogen levels. And typically, you do typically see a peak of estrogen prior to ovulation. So I think it's just good to be aware that, you know, a lot of these things we read about or see are textbook cycles, and there is a really wide variation of normal. And if you are concerned that you're not seeing enough cervical mucus, there are so many things that can be done about it. And that's definitely something to chat to your holistic health practitioner about, to see what you can do to encourage more cervical mucus production.
Absolutely. And I love that you said there that, you know, the presence of, watery or egg white mucus doesn't guarantee that you've ovulated, because that's actually something, admittedly, that I relearned in the process of getting further educated on this, because like many people just reading very textbook style stuff, and in when I was beginning learning about this, my assumption was, even as a healthcare practitioner, that when there is egg white mucus that you've definitely ovulated. And so I love that you pointed that out, because I can't be the only one that's had that misinformed or half truth there. So really, really good to know.
Absolutely. That's a really common one. So many people believe that if they've seen egg white mucus, egg white style mucus, then they've ovulated. So it's not true, but I'm glad that resonated with you, because that's definitely a big one. And it can be really confusing for people as well. If you're tracking your cycle and you think that means you've ovulated, but then you see it again, or you get your period at a different time than you thought you would, it can be really confusing. So it's something to be aware of for sure.
Yes, yes. So in terms of, you know, fertile windows, how long is a fertile window actually? So if someone doesn't want to get pregnant, when would they need to start kind of either not having sex or using another form of contraception, for example, like using condoms?
This is a fantastic question, and I can't really give a nice basic universal answer to this question. So I guess we can break it down by saying that when I'm teaching the symptothermal method and I'm talking about a fertile window, there's really two definitions. So number one is the biological fertile window, and number two is the fertile window as identified by the symptothermal method, and they are two separate things. So the biological fertile window is just 6 to 9 days. That's it. Like, that is the entire span of the time that you are fertile during any menstrual cycle, and that takes into account the lifespan of sperm being 5 to 7 days, and the lifespan of the human egg, which is 24 hours, but you can release a second, which would take that to 48 hours. So mm-hmm. 6 to 9 days, lifespan of the sperm and the egg, and that's it. That is the only time of your menstrual cycle that you can become pregnant. But where things get a little bit confusing is that we can't predict in advance when that ovulation event will occur. And so using the symptothermal method, we never ever pinpoint ovulation. We don't predict when ovulation will occur. That's simply not possible. But what we do with the symptothermal method is that we monitor fertility biomarkers, which are outward signs of our inward biology and our hormones. And they tell us, they kind of give us clues as to what phase of our cycle we're in. And the fertile window, as identified by the symptothermal method, is always significantly longer than that 6 to 9 day actual biological fertile window. So usually, just say in a typical 28-day menstrual cycle, it would be at least 11 days that the symptothermal method would identify as potentially fertile. And again, don't just take that 11 days and kind of add them onto your cycle and hope for the best. I have seen people do that. It's not a good idea. This is purely based on observing your cervical mucus and your basal body temperature, and also some calculations as well, which we use to just double check things. So I guess, yeah, short answer is, we're not fertile for, you know, our entire menstrual cycle, which a lot of us may have been led to believe by our
high school when they're the idea in sex ed is if you even look at a penis, you will get pregnant.
Exactly. There's so much fear mongering. Like you just have to laugh about it because it's just outrageous. I mean, the sad thing is that a lot of us get into our 20s and our 30s and we decide that we want to try for a baby. And suddenly it's like, well, that wasn't true because it's a lot harder than I thought, you know. So it's this sudden, you have to kind of suddenly change the way you think about it. So, yeah, I mean, as females on our own, we're really only fertile ourselves for 48 hours, well, 24 to 48 hours each menstrual cycle. And then obviously we add on the last vernal sperm. But on our own, it's just this tiny window of time that we're fertile. So, yeah, there's no easy answer to that, but your individual chart will show the actual length of time that you would need to be abstaining, and that's based on all those things I just mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and you can, you know, even just as you're speaking, Jessie, I can see why, you know, having a teacher in the beginning is so invaluable, because I think it is really about learning all of these intricacies. And at first, even I'm sure some people listening are like, oh my goodness, this is a lot. And anything when you're first learning it is, but I feel like it becomes so much easier just as you know what you're looking out for, and you, nobody knows your body better than you. And I see the role of a practitioner in this space is really helping you understand what your body is telling you, and then being able to use that skill for life. Because once you learn the basics and what the different changes and messages mean, you're able to adjust and don't have to outsource it to an app, for example.
Exactly. And, you know, that's so valuable, having that internal knowledge. It's like once you have the knowledge, nobody can take it away from you. And it's this incredible innate skill that you take with you throughout your life. And I like what you were saying about the value of an instructor. And I actually like to kind of link that back to being an adolescent. If you've ever learned to drive a car, you would have made sure that you had either an instructor or a parent in the passenger seat, because it was probably, if you learned with a manual, maybe not with an automatic, but if you learned to drive a manual car, you would have had someone really making sure you were safe the whole time, because it does come with an element of risk, and it is a whole new world to suddenly get your head around. And learning the symptothermal method or any type of FABM is very similar to learning to drive a car. You really do need that support to begin with, but once you've got it, you're off and away, and you've got that freedom and that independence.
I love that analogy. So good. I only once tried to drive a manual car, and it was actually way after I'd learned to drive when I met my husband, and he thought it'd be a good idea to try and teach me. It did not go well.
Oh no. I can imagine it was very stressful.
Oh goodness. I'm like not a good driver at the best of times. And then in a manual car, let's be honest, I was only doing it to impress him, and it backfired. It did not work.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm glad you're here to tell the tale. You survived.
I am. And such a good analogy. I really, really like that. So now what I want to do is ask you a few kind of quick fire type questions, but you can give long answers if they require, particularly around kind of tracking temperatures, because I get a lot of questions about this as well, and had and have similar questions when I was learning how to track my cycle, because it can be very confusing. So the first one is, what does it mean if no temperature shift occurs?
So usually if a temperature shift doesn't occur, then we would call that a monophasic chart, which means that the temperatures are all on a single level, a single phase. And what that usually means is that ovulation has not occurred. I mean, there are obviously sometimes exceptions to this, but usually it means that it was an anovulatory chart and no ovulation occurred. And the reason that we say that is because ovulation is the way that we produce a hormone called progesterone. And progesterone causes our temperatures to rise and then stay risen until our next period. So if we see a chart with no temperature rise, it usually means that we have not ovulated.
And how, just for context for people listening, I probably should have framed this, but how much does our temperature need to actually rise to constitute a rise?
So the absolute minimum is at least 0.2 degrees Celsius. And keep in mind that that should be a sustained rise. So sometimes I see people that just see one little temp and it's risen and they're like, oh, I must have ovulated. But no, we need to be seeing two different levels. So we want to see a biphasic chart with a lower level in the follicular phase leading up to ovulation. And then after ovulation, a higher level of temperatures up until your next period. And we've got specific rules that we use with the symptothermal method to evaluate whether a temperature shift will meet those rules. But at a very, very, very basic level, you do want to see it shift upwards at a minimum of 0.2 degrees Celsius.
Yes, good to know, because I've definitely had similar questions of, oh, I saw a shift, and I'm like, oh, awesome, so what were your temperatures? And there was just one that goes up. So I love that you explained that. Okay, so next one is, what does it mean if your temperatures are erratic in the first half of your cycle?
Wow, there's so many different...
How long is a piece of string?
Yeah.
Maybe exactly. Some examples.
So there are so many things that can actually impact our temperatures. So for anyone who's listening and not really sure, when we're using a fertility awareness-based method that involves tracking our temperatures, we're actually referring to our core resting temperature or our basal body temperature. And that usually we usually reach that when we've been resting all night and our body is in a state of rest. So that usually happens around 4:30 in the morning. But there are many, many different things that impact it. So if you are drinking alcohol the night prior, if you've had a really late meal, a heavy meal, like a big bowl of pasta at like midnight or 2 a.m., then you may see your temperatures be significantly higher than expected the next day. If you've got your aircon turned on, you don't usually, then it might be lower. Or if you've got, maybe your temperature, your thermometer is faulty. Maybe you're getting an illness and you don't know, and it's the first sign that you've got a fever. So there are so many different things that can impact our temperature. I mean, there's also, you could take it at a different time than usual, because usually we keep to within a specific time frame. Or you might have had a really disturbed sleep and you might not have had at least 3 hours of sleep prior to taking your temperature. So there are many, many, many different things that can impact the stability of our temperatures in the follicular phase. Another thing, though, that can impact it is stress, whether that's physical, mental, or emotional stress. I have seen a lot of the time when people are dealing with hormonal imbalance and a lot of stress in their lives, it's more common to see a really dysregulated temperature pattern, which is spiking up and down. So there are a million different reasons. And that's where I usually say to people, look, if it's really all over the place, it might be time to go. And if you've ruled out everything else, it might be time to go work with a holistic health practitioner, investigating what you can do to support your body. So yeah, it's a, yeah, how long is a piece of string, really?
yeah. But they're such good common examples. And I think actually it was in your Chart to Conceive course, which I highly recommend, you gave the tip as well of popping your thermometer underneath your pillow when you sleep, if you sleep with aircon on, or sometimes you do or sometimes you don't. And I feel like that's such a good little hack that you can do, because I can imagine that, you know, some nights people might put air conditioning on or a fan on and then they won't. And it's really, I can imagine you're wanting to compare apples with apples when you're doing this basal body temperature tracking as much as possible. So do you recommend people do that anyway, or is it something where you just recommend it if people are seeing those really erratic temperatures?
I recommend it anyway. It doesn't really take much time or effort to pop it under your pillow, and I definitely think it's a good idea to reduce the environmental disturbances on that thermometer. But yeah, there's so much more that can be done as well. So if you are seeing these really erratic charts, if you speak with your instructor and speak with them about how to address it, there's so many things that we can do to find a way for you personally that's going to work, because everyone is so unique and different, and there are going to be different solutions for each person. But usually we can find a way to get those temperatures smoothed out nicely. And if not, then that's when I usually refer people on to a health practitioner.
So good. All right. So what about erratic temperatures in the second half of your cycle?
So again, this is exactly like I said before, there's so many different things. All those things I mentioned earlier can impact temperatures in this phase of the cycle and all phases of the cycle as well. But sometimes, again, stress can impact this phase of the cycle, because your body is producing progesterone, and if you're really, really stressed, that can definitely impact the output of progesterone in the body, and that can mean that our temperatures are a little crazy. And you know, on top of that, if you're not making a lot of progesterone and your temperatures are dropping below that cover line, then that can be an indication of issues with progesterone, whether that's supply of progesterone or the way your body responds to progesterone. There's lots of different things that a health practitioner can look into. And again, I'm not trained on this side of things, so I usually see a chart like this and I will usually refer people onward. But in saying that, I always tell everyone, don't panic if your chart doesn't look textbook, because we're not robots and our charts are inadvertently, they're always going to have a little bit of craziness to them because it's real life. But usually there's ways around it.
Yeah. Yep. I love that. Okay. Second last one is, what does it mean if you see a temperature shift, but then it isn't actually sustained?
So like we mentioned earlier, if you're seeing just one or two temperatures shifting upwards and then they drop below again, and it's not it's not sustained for the entirety of the luteal phase. Oh, it looks as though my connection is unstable. So hopefully I'm still here, but anyway.
Yep, you're still there. Keep going.
oh, good. I'm still here. So yeah, essentially if the temperature shift is not sustained, then it's not going to count as a true temperature shift. And the symptothermal method has very specific rules to analyze that shift and find out whether it is a valid temperature shift. But usually if you just see a spike and it's not sustained, it drops back down to that lower level, that generally means that you haven't ovulated. It was probably just an anomaly or some strange reason that it jumped up, and yeah, you need to keep temping.
Love it. And then what about if someone's temperatures are consistently low, and how low is low when it comes to tracking your temperature?
This is a good question as well. And again, this is another one of those how long is a piece of string questions. So, I mean, the normal that, you know, we talk about all the time in textbooks and that sort of thing is 36.5 degrees Celsius. So during the follicular phase, which is from the first day of your period up until the day of ovulation, and including the day of ovulation, we usually would see temperatures hovering around 36.5 degrees Celsius. However, in saying that, there is a wide range of normal and there are so many different things that can affect it. So you may be using a basal body temperature thermometer that is calibrated differently. It might be calibrated lower or higher. And there, again, there are so many things that can impact that temperature. If you are seeing consistently low temperatures, so that, you know, 35.8, 35.7 degrees Celsius or something like that, and you feel totally fine, then I wouldn't panic. But if you are having really, really low temperatures and you're also experiencing symptoms that you just don't feel right, and it's looking as though this could be a sign of something else, then that's when I always tell people to head off and see someone. Because if you are experiencing super low temperatures, it can sometimes indicate, as you would know, Natalie, it can sometimes indicate an underperforming thyroid. Mm-hmm. And obviously I'd be telling clients, you know, if you're experiencing a lot of fatigue, a lot of hair loss, your mm-hmm. eyebrows are falling out, if you're really not feeling good, then that is the time to go and investigate that. But if you're feeling sprightly and energetic and you're just on top of the world and you just happen to have low temperatures, then I would say, look, I wouldn't worry about that. But if it's mm-hmm. in combination with signs and symptoms where your body is sending you messages that something's not right, then regardless of what your temperature is, it's always a good idea to look into that.
Yeah, I so agree with that. I think sometimes there is a bit of a tendency to panic and read into something based on one number, even if it doesn't match how you feel. And I'm always similar to you telling people, you know, the two need to make sense together, what you're tracking and how you're feeling as well. Because, you know, as you said, you might be feeling absolutely on top of the world and have low temperatures, and, you know, it's not, you know, you're not going to have, not very likely to have an issue if you're feeling amazing, yet the only yeah. thing that's, you know, giving you any indication is a bit of a low temperature. So thank you for pointing that out. I do have one other question that's just popped in my mind as one that one of my clients said, can you please ask her this on the podcast? Because I know that it will be a question that everyone else wants to ask. And that is, can you get pregnant when you're on your period?
Yes, this is a fantastic question. You definitely can get pregnant on your period. And I have an entire blog post about this on my website. And to this day, it remains probably the most popular blog I've ever written. So this is a question that unites everyone around the world who gets periods, because I think we've all been curious about this at one point or another. But yeah, there is the possibility to fall pregnant from having intercourse while you're on your period. And there are many different ways that this can happen. So I'll just go through a few. But if you have very short cycles, what this means is that your day of ovulation is a lot closer to the end of your period. And remember that sperm can survive up to 5 to 7 days in the reproductive tract. So if you had sex at the end of your, you know, tail end of your period, and those sperm just happen to survive, you know, 5 days or so, and you have an early ovulation, then you can definitely become pregnant from that. It is relatively unlikely. However, it's definitely possible, and I have seen chance where that has happened. So it's definitely keep that in mind. You're not automatically safe just because you're on your period. And I definitely recommend working with an instructor or purchasing an official method manual if you want to really make sure that you're going to be safe. Another thing is that, you know, unless you're charting, you actually don't have any evidence that the period you're experiencing is a true period. Mm. So a true period is any bleeding that was preceded 10 to 16 days prior by ovulation. And we confirm that with our specific rules of the method. But if you didn't confirm ovulation with a chart, you know, 10 to 16 days prior, and you're now experiencing bleeding, then what that means is, you know, it could be breakthrough bleeding, which is, you know, the lining of your uterus has built up and built up, you haven't ovulated, you're going to have a breakthrough bleed, and you can ovulate really soon, you know, very soon, during or after that breakthrough bleeding. And in addition to that, there's also this thing called ovulatory bleeding or mid-cycle spotting, which some people can confuse for a period. So you might think that you're on your period, but it might even be ovulatory mid-cycle spotting. So mm-hmm. you might think, I'm safe, I'm on my period, but you might in reality literally be ovulating,
yeah,
you know, exactly that week. So
it's gone wrong, hasn't it?
yeah. So I do recommend, if you do want to have sex on your period, it's definitely possible for many people, but it's important to be charting and make sure you've got a really thorough understanding of how the rules are going to apply to your specific chart, because everyone's different. For some people, it's going to be fine on a specific chart. For others, it's definitely a no-no. So, yeah, it really depends on charting.
Yes, gosh, so much to know and so much to learn, but how empowering, hey, to like really know your body and your cycle. And I wish like some of this stuff was taught to teenagers, even getting to know their body, because I mean, gosh, I feel like I only know it because I'm genuinely interested in this area, for, you know, first of all, for professional reasons, and then it came into my life for personal reasons. And I can imagine that a lot of people, it's, you know, not even on their radar, when I personally find it's so empowering and can give you so much information, because it's, you know, like your period is your monthly report card. I think it was Lara Bryden that first said that, at least when I first heard it. And I thought, gosh, that's such a good way of framing things. And I also love bringing the attention to ovulation as being very much the main event of a cycle, in my opinion as well, because it's not a guarantee that you'll ovulate. And I feel like ovulating is such a good sign that the body is, you know, in a position where it's able and willing to reproduce because it feels safe and capable to do so from a biological standpoint. And I think sometimes we're trained to think that if we have a period, that's it, like we're good to go. And while it is, it's a great sign, I think the whole ovulation side of things needs a little bit more attention.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I totally agree with you. I really think this information should be taught to teenagers in high school, not necessarily from a pregnancy prevention standpoint, but definitely from a health standpoint and a body literacy standpoint, because that information is so incredibly empowering. And like you say, you take that information with you into the future and it informs so many things, because once we understand how our inner world changes through each of these different cycles, it really informs who we are as a person and how we interact with the world around us as well. So I really agree. I just think this information is so empowering, so incredible. And I really believe it's a birthright of anyone who's born with a uterus to know how the uterus works, right? Like it's, you know, I really do feel quite strongly about that. I mean, you could say, I guess, anyone who's born with like a kidney or a heart or a liver should know how it works. But I really think the uterus is such a beautiful organ and does so much for us. And it's so empowering to know how it works.
Yes, I so agree. Or even just to know where it bloody is, because I don't know about you, but I get so many questions, and understandably, like where, like what's my vulva, what's my vagina, where's my uterus, where's my cervix, you know? And like, I didn't know until I was actually started to be interested in this kind of stuff. And I feel like it's one of those questions sometimes in my experience that clients can feel a little bit of shame or silly about asking, because they're grown women and they aren't sure what their anatomy is or where things are happening. And I just think, you know, there's A, no shame around it, because how would you know if no one's taught you? But B, like, why aren't we teaching this?
I absolutely agree. And I think that's something I've made a really big effort with my teaching and my online courses, is that we deep dive into reproductive anatomy as a very first step, because, you know, being able to hold up a hand mirror to your vulva and name the parts of your body and feel familiar and comfortable to do so it's vital. It's so incredibly important. And not only from an empowerment standpoint, but also from a health standpoint, because I know a lot of older women inadvertently end up with health issues that they would have caught earlier if they were more comfortable self-assessing the vulva, and if they're more comfortable looking at the different body parts and understanding what those different body parts are. So yeah, I definitely agree. It's so important to have that foundational knowledge, and it's definitely not something to be ashamed of at all, because you know, the amount of people that have never had the privilege of learning this information is absolutely phenomenal. And I mean, I think back to when I was about 12 years old, and maybe even, no, I was probably about 12, and I came home from sex ed in intermediate school, and I said to my mum, "Oh my gosh, we have three holes? I didn't know we had three holes."
Yeah.
And it's that basic information that we deserve knowing that information, and I wish I'd known that a lot earlier. because
you know, I totally agree. And I think, you know, it's, I feel like maybe it's the circles I'm floating in, but I feel like it's slowly becoming less taboo, so to speak, to talk about it, and more women are feeling more empowered or interested in getting to know their bodies. But I still feel like there is a lot of work to do, and I'm glad that you're passionately out there doing a lot of this work. And I so can highly recommend your website and your blog posts and your course that you've already released. And
thank you.
You're also going to be releasing a new one very soon, if it's not already out by the time this is released. Do you want to tell us, just while we're on the topic of that, where people can actually find you and what offerings you do have at the moment and that are coming up?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you head to my website, which is fertilitycharting.com.au, I have a wealth of information there. So I've got cervical mucus galleries, I've got instructor directories, I've got tons and tons of free resources and blog posts that you can just scroll through to learn more about the body. And I also have the beautiful Chart to Conceive course, which you're familiar with, Natalie.
Yes,
and and I am currently in the process of building out an incredible natural contraception course, which I've actually been working on for over a year now. So it's an enormous undertaking, and I am getting closer and closer to releasing that. So hopefully by the time this podcast airs, I might actually be able to say that I've launched it, but I won't hold my breath on that one because I'm notoriously slow and perfectionist. So those are the things that I have on my website, and I'm also on social media. My Instagram handle is Fertility Charting, and I would always love to see you there because I'm pretty active over on my social media most of the time. So yeah.
Amazing. And I'll make sure there's links to all of that in the show notes as well. And I would definitely encourage anyone who is interested in their body to check out all of your resources, because it's somewhere where I'm constantly referring clients to, because I just think, even that like gallery, the cervical mucus gallery, because so many people ask me and you can describe it, but then seeing it is such a different thing. And it's so good that you've got that there. So thank you for all of the information that you've shared with us today and that you continue to share. And I'm really excited to see the next course be released. Really exciting.
Thanks so much, Natalie. It was such a pleasure talking about all of my favorite subjects with you. It was amazing.